From the Geddes Virgin and 91.1 WZBT Gettysburg, I'm Jamie Welch, and this is On Target.
I'm Ben Pons. Today on Target, we'll take another look at the college's new unauthorized recording policy. We've received an explanation from the dean's office.
Then, we'll talk to history professor and former editor of the Geddes Virgin, Michael Berkner. He'll give his thoughts on the Confederate monument controversy and reflect on his time as a student and as editor of the Geddes Virgin. Stay with us.
All right, well, we are here for our second episode of On Target. We're recording this news segment on Saturday in the afternoon. The first thing we're going to get into is the college's new unauthorized recording policy. We talked about this a little bit last week, and there was a staff editorial in our print edition and online last week. We have since received some clarification from the dean's office. So, Jamie, can you kind of get into it? Give us a little bit of a summary of what the policy is in case anyone's unfamiliar, and then talk a little bit about what Dean Ramsey, Dean Julie Ramsey, our Dean of Students here at the college, had to say in an editorial that will appear in this week's print edition of the Geddes Virgin.
Yeah, so the unauthorized recording policy was created basically to protect students from unwanted and non-consensual recordings of, and the college defines these recordings as photos, videos, and audio recordings. The way that the policy was written, it was very broad in scope, and the editorial board of the Geddes Virgin just felt that it was way too much of an overreach. So we wrote an editorial in the Geddes Virgin, and the dean's office reached out to us with a letter of clarification to sort of address some of the issues that we brought up.
The college said, you have a reasonable expectation of privacy anywhere indoors. In other words, if it's exposed to the weather, I believe was the quote from Ron Wiaffe, yep, the director of student rights and responsibilities. He said that if it's an area is exposed to the weather, then you do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and anywhere else you do. And we pointed out in our editorial that that would mean places like Servo, the library, clearly public places. Any photos, videos, or audio taken in there would be a violation of this policy. And what we heard from Dean Ramsey was, well, that's not actually how we're interpreting it. A bit of a change, perhaps.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. So she said that basically any place where there's a public space on campus, so that includes Servo and the library and the Cub, these would all be considered public spaces where you do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, places where she did say that you would have a reasonable expectation of privacy would be places like a classroom where there's a class being held, and also in a residence hall room. But basically any public event or a public space would be somewhere where you would not have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So I interpret that to also include lectures, even if they are held in classrooms, if they're open to the public, not normal class meetings. But basically any event open to the public, she has clarified as being a public space.
Yeah. And, you know, she also mentioned we had pointed out that the communications and marketing office frequently takes photos indoors in places that, using the initial definition that we were given from Ron Wiaffe, would, you know, be a violation. She says that they employ a policy of obtaining verbal consent before photos or videos are taken during times when there is a reasonable expectation of privacy. We noted that during opening day or move-in day, there were some photos that were taken in residence halls of students moving in. And, I mean, certainly it was not, you know, an incognito thing, but, you know, that would, by the letter of this policy, particularly how it was interpreted and arguably, I think how it's portrayed in this letter, she still explicitly mentions residential facilities. I think there's still a question about that.
Yeah. And I would also definitely say, you know, in regard to those photos, she's sort of refuting, you know, saying that there was verbal consent. But I've spoken with several students who were in those photos, and they said that they never were asked permission if the photo could be taken. So, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, accuse Dean Ramsey of anything, but I'm just saying that maybe that's something that the marketing office needs to be more intentional about. If that's what they're supposed to be doing, I'm not sure if that's happening in all cases.
Yeah, I don't think we've reached the end of the conversation about this just yet. Moving on, just a few other things going on. Just a general public service announcement, I guess you could say. We are now officially to the point where in the 717 area code, they have run out of phone numbers. So they are starting a second area code. But what this means is that 10-digit dialing is now a requirement to make a call within the 717 area code. So whereas previously you could call just 337 wherever in the Gettysburg area, you now need to make sure that you're dialing 717-337 and then whatever the phone number is or whatever, you know, wherever you're calling. So that's just a general announcement, and I think we're all adjusting to that, including probably the college.
Absolutely, yeah. The college had to reprogram all the telephones, actually, to allow for this new type of dialing. So it was definitely a lot of work needed. But I know that almost all places in the country now have moved to 10-digit dialing. We were one of the last, actually, that still had 10-digit that still had the 7-digit dialing around and hadn't moved yet. So I guess it's sort of a modernization as the population grows in Pennsylvania.
I suppose you could look at it that way, although I believe the population in Pennsylvania is either contracting or growing slower than the national average, given that every time we redistrict, we lose seats. So we'll see how that effect is affected by the 2020 census. There's your political science major comment of the day. So in the news this week on campus, on Wednesday, the Center for Public Service held its Engage Expo, where they try and get students involved in public service throughout the campus. I know that one of the things this college prides itself on particularly is the number of students who participate in public service. We'll have coverage of that. One of our reporters was there, and we'll have coverage of that in this week's print edition and online, so I would encourage folks to check that out. Some interesting immersion projects going on this year, including one I know is headed to Morocco. I know they did that last year, but over winter break, I believe they'll be studying women's rights in Morocco. So you can potentially look into some of those. I know several students who have gone on these trips, and they've always said that they're a positive experience.
Yeah, and spaces do fill up fast. I know that some of these projects are already filled. So if you are interested in participating, I would apply sooner rather than later on the CPS website. I know that there, I forget which projects they are, but there was one project that filled up in 10 minutes.
Wow.
So definitely, if you are interested in participating in these opportunities, I would go to the CPS website and apply.
Indeed. In some other first week slash exciting news out of the biology department, Professor Ryan Kearney, who is working on, we have it here, solar salamanders. Is that right?
Yeah, it's I'm not really sure what it is exactly, but there's some sort of photosynthetic compound, I believe, in this particular species of salamander, and he's been researching it for a while, and he's received a grant I believe it's a multi-million-dollar grant. We're going to have more information on it in the Gettysburgian this week, but we just wanted to let you all know that this grant is just unbelievably huge. It's I think one of the larger grants that we've received here at Gettysburg College. When it was announced at the faculty meeting this week, there was an audible gasp from everyone in the room at the dollar amount of this. So it definitely is a really great accomplishment, and we'll have full coverage on the Gettysburgian's website this week.
Yeah, and perhaps we'll have to talk about getting Professor Kearney to come on and talk about it. Maybe he can explain to us what exactly that is. You've got a couple of very not natural science majors in the room.
Absolutely. Yeah, we would love to have him on. I think we'll be reaching out about having him on to discuss his great research.
Indeed. So there's some Gettysburg great work going on right there. What else we have? This was the first week of classes. So I've run into a few first years and asking them how it's going. They all seem to have survived. I don't think we had any fatalities during the first week, which is always a plus. How are your classes getting off to a good start, Jamie?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm really loving all my classes this semester. Really great professors. They all seem really interesting. But let me tell you, students talk about a syllabus week. That is a myth. I have had so much work already in my classes. We were learning on day one. So this whole syllabus week myth people talk about, it doesn't exist. It is definitely not present here at Gettysburg
the
College.
The Gettysburgian fact check on that is going to give it a big league.
Absolutely. That is completely accurate. Yes.
Yeah. I, the reason we're recording this and perhaps talking fast, I have to go write a paper after we're done with this. So we'll see how that goes. One other thing I wanted to mention, this is out of my favorite department on campus. I'm a little bit biased, but the political science department, Professor Douglas Page, who is a visiting assistant professor of political science. He was here last year. He's also here this year. Just won a pretty big award at the American Political Science Association's annual conference, which is happening right now this weekend out in San Francisco. Professor Page won an award for the best paper discussing sexuality and politics. So I know that's a big accomplishment for him. And so here at On Target at the Gettysburgian, we extend a heartfelt congratulations to Dr. Douglas Page of the Political Science Department. So congratulations to him. Maybe we'll talk to him about that in the future. We'll have to, lots of people we want to get on the podcast to talk about some things. In other news this week, some Dodging the Bullet articles. If you haven't been following along, we have our series called Dodging the Bullet, in which first-year students who are contributing writers or very soon to be staff writers of the Gettysburgian are reflecting on their experiences. And I think it's a really neat opportunity. We're seeing some great reflections. We had one this week on a first-generation college student talking about the adjustment, and I think she really did a nice job explaining that, and it's been playing well on our website. That was Gari Mangala, so congratulations to her on an excellent article. We've got some others coming up this week, so I'd encourage you to follow along with that series. You can go to gettysburgian.com/dodgingthebullet. Put hyphens in between dodging the and bullet.
Yeah, it is a fantastic series. I know the first year experience is really special here, and being able at Gettysburg and being able to capture that and share it with the greater campus community, I think it's really great, and it can help to bring us all together as we share stories. So it's really fantastic work by all of our new first year writers.
Indeed. So I think we're going to plug a few upcoming events. First on the agenda, I think it would be very appropriate to talk about our dear friend MidMad. Last week, I was made fun of by some for saying, quote, love me some MidMad, unquote. But I stand by that comment. The fact check on that is an affirmative. But we have another Midnight Madness coming up this week, and Jamie has some exciting news about that, about the menu.
Yes. So the Midnight Madness this week will be on Saturday, September 9th, and it will feature mozzarella sticks. That's right. Everyone's favorite snack in Servo is going to be there. It is the mozzarella sticks. It is going to be incredible. 11:30 to 1 on Saturday, September 9th. So we're super excited about that.
11:30?
11 to 1. Yeah, sorry about that.
There's another live fact check.
There,
we're into
there
the
it
fact
is.
Checks today, but you see, when we do live fact checking, you just, you know, check it on the spot. So
absolutely.
There you go. Mid-Mad Monsticks.
Yes.
Say that 10 times.
Mid-Mad Monsticks, 11 to 1. And of course, there's also all your venerable favorites like hot dogs and donuts as well. So I hope that I will see you there. I'll be there checking people in. So
my personal favorite aspect of Midnight Madness is actually not the fried food du jour. It is the donuts. Because
the donuts are highly premium. And they actually come from our friends over at Weiss. I believe that they provide the donuts. They are fantastic.
I am a big midnight. I'll eat donuts at any time of the day, Jamie. You know, midnight, morning, mid-afternoon.
Really, any time is donut time.
There's really not a bad time in my mind for donuts. Anyway, enough about that. Moving along, next Friday, Salsa on the Square on September the 8th. Jamie, what do we have about that?
So it's the kickoff to the National Hispanic Heritage Month. It's going to run from 5:30 to 11 p.m. on Friday the 8th. And basically, this is a big celebration that happens every year in the Gettysburg Circle, which they call the Square. It's right downtown.
We're good at geometry.
Yeah, so it's actually the 11th annual event. It will be it's going to observe 33 years of our sister city relationship with León in Nicaragua. Gettysburg is like a sister city with León, and that's a partnership with the college and the borough connected down there. It's Project Gettysburg León is the name of the organization. It's basically a big dance. It takes place on the first block of Carlisle Street. And there's going to be Latin music. There's going to be a bunch of food there, different vendors. It's really a fantastic time. The Gettysburg mayor, Ted Streeter, will make a proclamation declaring September 8th to be Hispanic Heritage Day in Gettysburg. The Nicaraguan ambassador, Francisco Campbell, will be there to speak.
He's the Nicaraguan ambassador to the United States. That's pretty impressive.
Yes, it is. And so the local food vendors include Casa de la Cultura, El Casteno, The Ragged Edge, and our very own Servo Express food truck will be there serving Latin favorites.
Well, I imagine that will be a very exciting event. I know that's always well attended, 5:30 to 11 on Friday. We'll, of course, have full coverage of that. But rather than reading about it, you could go experience it for yourself. So be sure to check that out. And one other thing, coming up at the Majestic Theater this Thursday through Sunday, the National Theater Live. Jamie, can you talk a little bit about this?
So the National Theater Live is it comes from the United Kingdom at the National Theater, and basically they record world-class productions of musicals and deliver them to theaters all over the country. So this is a festival. So basically it's replaying a bunch of old previously recorded live shows. There's Angels in America. What are some of the other ones?
Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's lots of different shows that are going to be airing. And it's all throughout the weekend. So there's going to be, I think, five or six different shows, but they're going to be airing at different times. So it's Thursday through Sunday. And for show times, you can go to GettysburgMajestic.org or you can call the box office at 717-337-8200. I believe student tickets are $12 and general admission tickets are $24. So you can see world-class programming for only $12 if you're a student here at Gettysburg.
Yeah, I was talking to someone about this earlier this week, and they were very excited, plotting out their Sunday around seeing Angels in America Part 2, I do believe.
Yeah, so. Well, Angels in America, I actually saw it when it was live back in August. It was absolutely fantastic. It talks about the AIDS epidemic when it was at its height. It follows several different people around and sort of their experiences. It's really fantastic, both Part 1 and Part 2. They both do stand alone, but if you watch them together, it definitely is a very, very special experience. I would recommend it to anyone.
All right. Well, in a moment, we'll be back with the Bullet Report and Sounds of Sunderman. This week on the Bullet Report, our weekly update on Gettysburg College Athletics, we've got a lot going on, including some exciting news out of the volleyball program. They are hosting this weekend the Battlefield Classic Volleyball Tournament. I believe there are five or six schools in attendance, but the exciting news on Friday and then earlier today, again, this is Saturday, they won their first three games, which puts them at 999 wins in program history. And as we speak, they are on the prowl for their 1,000th win, which would be their fourth win of this tournament, starting off the season potentially 4-0 if they get the win, and even if not, 3-1, a strong start. They'll play again at home this week on Wednesday against Catholic University. So you may be able to see, you know, a 1,000 win program. So that should be exciting. In other exciting news, our own sports editor, Elizabeth Hillfrank, finished seventh in the women's cross-country race that was held yesterday. So a big congratulations to her. The women's team, I believe, finished fourth, and the men's team, I believe, finished fifth. So that's exciting news. The football team kicked off its season last night by traveling to Bridgewater. They played a Friday night tilt in Virginia. They lost 27-24, a close game. They'll be at home next Saturday, the 9th, to play Ursinus, and that will kick off at 1 p.m. Lots of sports action heading your way this week. On Tuesday, the field hockey team travels to the Catholic University to play at 5. Women's soccer will play at Stevenson on Wednesday at 7. We mentioned the volleyball team hosts Catholic on 7. And then on the weekend, the women's cross-country team and the men's cross-country team will play. Yeah, you don't really play cross country. They will race Franklin and Marshall, Dickinson. That will be at 6 p.m. The volleyball team hosts Widener next Friday, also at 6. And then Keystone at 8. Men's soccer hosts Stevenson at 7. And then on Saturday, the volleyball team will host Dickinson at 10. Football or Sinus will be at home at 1 p.m. The field hockey team will play Cabrini College at noon on the road. And then the volleyball team, I guess this is interesting, they're playing at home at 10 and then traveling to Rowan to play at 2. I don't know how that's going to work, but luckily I'm not the logistics coordinator for that.
Oh, wow.
And then the women's soccer team will travel to Elizabethtown for a 7 p.m. tilt there just over in Lancaster County, which is one of my favorite counties in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Not that I'd be biased. So that is the Bullet Report. Now it's time for the Sounds of Sunderman segment, and this week we are featuring Rick Hale, a senior vocal soloist who performed the college alma mater at convocation last week, and I think that his performance was well received by everyone in attendance, so we're excited to share that with you. This is Rick Hale.
As softly the evening shadows are veiling the campus towers, we come, a band of good fellows, to sing in the twilight hours. The silvery moonlight mantles the worn walls of chapel anew. The wind in the tree sweetly echoes our praises of orange and blue. Whenever thy loyal ones gather to waken fond memory, our thoughts shall be turned alma mater, old Gettysburg, back to thee. Forever am I thy debtor, and whatever else I may do, I'll love, I'll defend, and I'll honor the glorious orange and blue.
We're back with more On Target.
And joining us today, we're pleased to have history professor Michael Berkner. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Ben. Glad to be here.
So I figured we'd start. We're recording this on Wednesday, August the 30th, and I guess last week or the week before, you wrote an op-ed in my hometown newspaper, Lancaster Online, about the monument controversy. And the title is Monuments Ought to Be Considered Case by Case, and I think that's the premise of your argument. Can you get into that a little bit?
Sure. As I pointed out in the article, Ben, the monuments issue is inherently an emotional issue. It's also obviously a historical issue, but it's your take on the history of the country and what's important to you. I would concede right at the outset that there are strong arguments that can be made on both sides of this, but I don't also think that it's not necessarily a two-sided story, because in my case, I can not be very comfortable with the idea of removing statues willy-nilly. I think there's all kinds of risk in doing that in terms of injuring our sense of history. But at the same time, I think the argument can be made that there are certain statues that are inappropriate or they're inappropriately placed, and we can think about how we want to deal with them. And as you noted in reading my article, I think, I suggested a couple different ways you can handle it.
Mm-hmm. So it would seem that based on your argument that on a battlefield, for example, in Gettysburg, when you know the monuments to certain Confederate groups would be contextualized in the larger context of the battle, that you would say that those are statues we probably don't need to rush to take down.
In fact, I wouldn't take them down at all. If you're talking about the Gettysburg battlefield in particular, I think contextualizing them is important for people. I don't think we should have any doubts as to who the good guys were and who the bad guys were in terms of the overall context of the war. But you could argue, for example, that the Gettysburg battlefield is a living museum. And so for those who say, well, take them out of certain places and put them in museums, well, the Confederate statues, including Lee, are in effect an outdoor museum here in Gettysburg. I can see other places where you would move statues, and I absolutely support the idea of moving Lee from Emancipation Park in downtown Charlottesville to a less prominent location. But other options include things like providing a plaque description, building another alternative statue, say, next to Stonewall Jackson, you can put Sojourner Truth and talk about that and talk about why she represents something really important and perhaps better. But there isn't really one right fix for what people see as a problem.
Mm-hmm. All right. So why don't we pivot a little bit? You attended Gettysburg a few years ago.
Yeah.
And we were, so I guess now might be a good time to plug that in the library, on the library's website, you can get to all of the old issues of the Gettysburgian dating back to 1897. And we found in 1972 an article that I guess you may have written that says Gettysburgian suspends publication after 75 years. And it looks like you had some trouble recruiting a staff. Do you remember anything about that?
Oh, I sure do. We had a wonderful newspaper, and that's not just a personal reflection. We won the top award from the Scholastic Newspaper Association of the United States for the Gettysburgian while I was editor, which was one of the proudest things of my 4 years at college. But this was a time when I think there was a diminution of interest in giving time to a student newspaper. The person who was my second in command at the paper was a rising senior after I was to pass the baton, and she had been basically burned out working really hard on it for 2 years, and she declined to take over. And then we recruited and recruited and recruited and didn't have any luck. What this was, in a way, was either a bluff or a wake-up call. We weren't going to end the Gettysburgian, but we couldn't figure out any other way to recruit a staff to keep it going, meaning top editors.
Right.
And as it turned out, a young man, a sophomore, who I was very friendly with, was willing to step to the plate. His name's Tom Bowl, class of 74, and he took it on and did a really good job. And we've been friends for the last 40-something years. But it was a kind of a bluff to get people to pay attention.
Well, that's kind of what it looked like, because we noted, I guess that was in January, and then in March we found, Tom Bowl to command new Burgeon staff. So do you remember, what was the print publication process like at that point?
Well, rather different than today, because you still had the hot type process of production. What this meant was that on Wednesday, let's see, I'm trying to do the math here. On Thursday night, I would walk up after I'd done all my proofreading. I would walk up to the Gettysburg Times office, which was then on Carlisle Street in a building that's directly across from the Majestic Theater and is now offices.
Okay.
And the time that was occupied by the Gettysburg Times. And I would throw the materials through a slot. And then at 8 o'clock the next morning, I would come into the Times, and they had linotypers who were making all the last-minute changes, and then they had these compositors who could read upside down, the lead type. And I would stand with them, and we would go over what they were doing, and then I would get quick wet sheets of what the final version of the paper was going to look like. So I and two or three others would come up on Friday and do the final reading. I considered that one of the most enjoyable things I ever did. There was a man who was a graduate of Gettysburg College from 1922 who was a circulation director or something of the Gettysburg Times, and he used to come over on Friday morning and give us the business about college students today and and so forth and so on. It was in good-natured stuff. But I really, and I loved talking with the compositors who were just average people who happened to do that as a job and but were extremely good at it. So it's a really good memory, Ben.
So the paper came out weekly.
It did on a Friday, and on Friday after 4:30 in the afternoon, it was carried in bulk to each dormitory and to the what was called the student union building in those days, the college union building today, and people lapped it up because it was a print era, and got a lot of response, and you felt like it was meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, that's a very different process than how we do it today. We actually don't get it printed at the Gettysburg Times anymore. We send it over to the Record Herald, and it's all done digitally now. We lay it out in InDesign, and so we don't get that experience. It sounds like it's really cool to be able to go and see them actually laying out everything and then hold that wet copy in your hands of, like, this is what the paper's going to look like, and seeing the plates and everything of that's just so awesome.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think it was a special experience. I mean, you can do more and in many ways do it better, I think, digitizing it and using the computer. For example, one of the things we did, which wouldn't make any sense to you anymore today, is when we wrote headlines like these, I would say and I wrote many of them, but I would say to the students who were doing it, you've got to get X number of spaces so that the headline matches. Or if you don't have it exactly match, you have to have it scaled. And we would spend a long time working on the headlines because you had to actually do it manually. And that was something that, of course, went away after offset came in.
Yeah, see, now we just have a justify button. It's very...
yeah, you
it's
save
very,
a lot
very
of,
easy to do.
You save a lot of time.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, sort of pivoting off the Gettysburgian and just your time here in general as a student, you know, what do you think your favorite memory is as your time here as a student?
Well, I really had many. I'll point out two, but specific favorite memory would probably be going to see Jesus Christ Superstar, the bootleg production that was that was done in 71, and it was the most electric thing I think I've ever attended in my life. This was a completely student run operation. There were four faculty members who played the high priests, and there was a chaplain's assistant who really was kind of the director. But the students really made it happen. There's a new book out on it by Devin McKinney of the library that is absolutely amazingly good, that captures the dynamic of that. That was certainly the single highlight. But if the first two things I was thinking about to your question were, first off, this was the era of great student protest against the Vietnam War, of questioning of the traditional values. It was a time when we had amazing speakers came to the campus on a regular basis, where the students ran their own symposium called Symposium 70, which brought for 3 days to the campus, and we stopped classes and brought speakers in by practically the cartload, notable speakers, including the former Attorney General of the U.S., presidents of corporations, Michael Harrington, the man who wrote The Other America, and Nat Hentoff, great jazz critic as well as a social commentator. Wonderful, amazing event for 3 days where we just stopped doing the normal things and talked about the issues of America. That was big deal. And because I was very active at the time with the Gettysburgian, I usually got opportunities over the course of those last 3 years in particular to have lunch or dinner with some notable, interesting authors and other political figures. So for a junkie like me in politics, it was heaven. The second very good memory I had, and it's one I don't think very many students have had since, although I don't know that the opportunity isn't there, is that I ate lunch every day with the faculty. In the old bullet hole in the Student Union building, which is really where the backside of the bookstore is today, a group of six or seven faculty members would gather, most of them political scientists or sociologists, would gather to have a hamburger or a sandwich and talk the current issues. And I knew them from class and other things, and they welcomed me. I was in a fraternity at that time, in which the fraternity served only dinner. So I was on my own for breakfast and lunch. And so my fraternity mates all ate lunch in the house and watched Jeopardy at noon. But I would go off to the bullet hole and have my lunch with the faculty. And I felt really grown up as a student, and if to use a colloquialism. And it really sparked, you know, my thinking, well, maybe that's a life I might want too someday.
So what was it like to, you know, be a student at Gettysburg and then to come back years later as a faculty member?
Well, I don't think it's an uncommon thing. We have probably a dozen or more faculty members here who've done the same thing in departments across the board. I suppose the first year you come back, you have the issue of, do you call your old professors by their first names, that kind of thing. I did come back 6 years after I left for 1 year to fill in for a faculty member who was ill. And it was a great experience. In fact, I was advisor to the Gettysburgian, along with Ted Baskerville, who had been my mentor. And I made friends with those students, and who are still my friends to this day. Then I left for 10 more years and did taught at various places. I was a journalist for 3 years in New Hampshire. I edited the papers of Daniel Webster at Dartmouth College and taught at Dartmouth College for a couple years, et cetera. And then I came back. So I was almost 40 years old when I came back, and I was in mid-career. I was recruited back to the college to take the department into a new era where they had a lot of retirements or old people on the cusp of retirement. They wanted me to come in and reshape it, which I think I did.
Mm-hmm. And so now that you kind of have memories of the campus as a student and a faculty member, what is it like to see the construction happening at, you know, significant places such as the Cub, the Student Union building, now the College Union building? Is it odd at all to see those buildings in?
Well, I think not so much. I think, for example, when I came back in 1989, the students used to call Gettysburg the College of Orange Mesh because there were so many different construction projects going on. Most of them were renovation projects, the two most prominent being they added a fourth floor to Wydenstall Hall, where I teach, and they also broke into the fourth floor of Glatfelter Hall to create the management department space. Mm-hmm. And those were major projects, and they had a couple others going as well. So these kinds of things happen on a cyclical basis. Certainly in the last 15 years, we saw the big addition to the physical facilities, or the physical fitness facilities, we saw the building of the Science Center, among other things. The college has not had great luck with getting big gifts to do big projects, so it tends to do these projects essentially as renovations, which is what they've been doing, and they're doing well with it.
Mm-hmm. I know that a lot has changed since you were here, but could you maybe reflect on some of what has stayed the same about Gettysburg College since the time you were here until now?
I think what stayed the same is the mission and the attitude of the faculty toward students. I'm not saying that the whole gestalt of the faculty is the same, because it isn't. There have been evolutionary changes, and if you had time, I could go into some of those. But you asked the question of what's the same, and I think that there's not a significant difference between how students and faculty connect with one another, both inside and outside the classroom. The classes remain pretty small. It's a very much hands-on kind of learning. The faculty knows your name. The faculty knows if you've been up to speed, and if not, they work with you to try to get you there. And if you're really a person of ambition and you're doing really well, they'll find new enrichments and opportunities for you. I think that's been Gettysburg. I think that just to give you one example, looking, you know, beyond Gettysburg, one of the reasons our students do very well in graduate programs and indeed getting where they want to go is that when faculty members write letters of recommendation for students, they actually can write a page or two because they know the students. Whereas you have a faculty member at a state university who's writing you a recommendation, and it's often pretty perfunctory. I know this student and I'm sure he's going to do well in your graduate program. Well, specificity always matters when you're recommending somebody. And we are in a position to be very specific about our students' strengths and whether it's the right program for them. So I think it's the mission fundamentally that's the same.
Mm-hmm. And probably we have time for maybe one more question. As you kind of consider the remainder of your career in the history department, what are you still looking to do? What's on your list of agenda items?
Well, that's a fine question. And you really have to have a priority list of what you want to do. Since I don't know when I'm going to retire, it's not like I have to set something up very formally. But, I've always got works in progress. I'm trying to finish a book on the presidential election of 1952. I'm in the middle of, editing a book on a war correspondent from the Second World War, whose dispatches I've read and think are wonderful and want to see in print. I'm in the third volume of a series of books I've edited on James Buchanan, have a contract from Louisiana State University Press, working with a couple of other distinguished scholars to try to get that book of essays done and in print by next year. And then I have a bunch of smaller academic and scholarly projects that I work on as well. As far as the teaching goes, I think at this stage in my career, I'm probably not going to do anything dramatically different. What I would love to do would be to teach a course in oral history, which is one of my real interests. Unfortunately, we don't do the January term anymore, which would be an absolutely perfect vehicle for a course on oral history with students. It's hard to justify making it a semester-long course, even though I could do that. So that may not happen. But all in all, I've got plenty to keep me busy, and I teach a wide menu of courses, including Australian history, which I'm teaching this term. I love it, and the students seem to be interested because I always have a good crowd. So I would say I'm counting my blessings, Ben.
Well, we're happy to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us, Professor Michael Berkner.
That's On Target for this week. Next time on Target, Student Senate President Luke Freegun will join us to discuss his agenda for the coming year. We'd like to invite you to submit questions to us by emailing editors@gettysburgeon.com.
We'd like to thank Professor Michael Berkner for being our featured guest today. We'd also like to thank the staff of the Gettysburgeon and the executive board of WZBT for their support of this project. Please subscribe to our podcast. You can search us in iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts, as long as it's iTunes or Stitcher.
On Target is a joint production of the Gettysburgeon and WZBT. Our theme music was composed by Diego Rocha of the class of 2019, who is a music major focusing on composition from the Sunderman Conservatory of Music.